This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Hello and welcome to Heritage Matters, a program brought to you by the Southern Heritage Trust. I'm Dougal Stevenson. In this program, Bill Southworth looks at a new book about the theologian Sir Lloyd Gearing and the real story behind his heresy trial. We look at two famous plastic surgeons from Dunedin, and Alison Breeze tells us about a new innovation to get children interested in heritage buildings. A deep, factual investigation into the truthfulness of the Bible can get you into hot water. It did do for theologian Sir Lloyd Gearing, who ended up facing heresy charges in 1967. Now, a new book says his trial was actually a clash between liberal Dunedin Presbyterians and conservative Aucklanders. This report from Bill Southworth.
If the Christian God is waiting for Lloyd Gearing to repent, he's giving him a long time to do so. Gearing is now 107 years old, New Zealand's oldest man. He lives at a rest home in Lower Hutt. The hearing, set up in the late 1960s by the Presbyterian Church to see whether the Knox College Theological Hall principal should face heresy charges, has been covered by this program before. But now a new book is throwing more light on the subject. It's called Lloyd Gearing, Prophet or Heretic, by Jim Veitch, a retired Associate Professor of Religious Studies at Victoria University. Gearing, who incidentally was a former Ducks of Otago Boys High School, attracted the wrath of conservative Presbyterians in Auckland when he published two articles in a church magazine in 1966, which showed the conclusions of modern theologians about some basic fundamentals in the Bible. In this first article, he wrote,
"The Bible is not literally inerrant. The Bible is not the Word of God in written form. The Bible is not a simple guide setting forth what every Christian in every generation must believe and do. It is a book from the ancient world and must be studied in the light of modern scholarship. There does not exist a clear and definitive guide as believers believe to exist."
And in the second magazine article, he went on to say,
"The story of the empty tomb, from which, presumably, that mortal body had come to life again and departed elsewhere, can only be a legend, a very beautiful and attractive legend, and one that will continue to speak powerfully to us."
In fact, the belief in resurrections was not new and had been mentioned in the Old Testament. The idea appealed to the ancients, who believed in a three-decker world of heaven, earth, and hell. Their knowledge of the way the universe is put together was much less than it is today. Gearing wrote,
"This discussion is primarily for those who know that the mythical three-decker universe is not the real tangible world in which we live, and because of that are genuinely puzzled to know what modern man is to make of such an important affirmation as the resurrection of Jesus."
The articles produced a reaction, particularly in Auckland, that Gearing did not anticipate. Among Auckland Presbyterians, there was a strong evangelical streak, present in at least a dozen of their parishes, people who clung to the old-time religion. Ministers and senior laymen passed a vote of no confidence in him and wanted him to resign. There was also criticism of Gearing's Knox Theological Hall. His northern opponents believed the staff at the hall had been stacked with men of liberal or modernistic views. They went even further. They wanted a second theological college set up in Auckland to counter what they saw as Dunedin's liberal theological teachings. In the meantime, they wrote to Gearing saying,
"There is a real connection between the earthly body of Jesus and the resurrection body, although the latter was manifestly different. It is the connection of the seed with the mature plant. Do you not agree?"
Gearing did not.
"Any gardener knows that you'll find your old seed potato when you dig your spuds. But no one is fool enough to eat it along with that it has brought forth."
Gearing has been accused of doctrinal error, which is more or less the same thing as heresy. And there was another charge. They wanted him dismissed for disturbing the peace of the church. and as he quipped in his later heresy trial to an audience that hung on his every word, it was not the peace of the church he disturbed, but rather its sleepiness. The articles were very painful for people who drew hope from what they believed to be the fundamental and precious truths of Christianity. Gehring was deeply aware of this and had consideration for their feelings, but even his gentle touch still produced a strong blowback. One woman in Auckland wrote this to him.
"It is quite clear that you are an atheist with a Christian cloak. Your statements on established historical facts of Christianity are so ridiculous that you cannot see yourself. You get away with it because of the deplorable state of the church and the materialistic age we live in at the present."
But Gehring had his supporters. One minister wrote to him from Auckland saying that the North had some unhealthy pockets and that he found them a darn sight more intractable than the most hardened sinners. The Presbyterian Church in Dunedin stood by him and issued a statement supporting the principle of free inquiry and said it was a mark of a healthy church when differences could be discussed in a spirit of tolerance and mutual respect. Nevertheless, the pressures from Auckland continued. A layman's group was formed and a protest meeting of 1,700 people was held in the Auckland Town Hall, chaired by the mayor. The meeting endorsed its belief in the resurrection, the attainment of eternal life, and the complete dependability of the Bible. A few months later, at a church meeting in Wellington, Gehring said that man has no immortal soul, that survives the death of the body and then goes on to a spiritual dwelling elsewhere. The comment was picked up by the Dominion newspaper, and the headline, "Man has no immortal soul," was emblazoned on billboards across Wellington. Eventually, formal charges were laid against him by a group of Auckland conservative laymen and a conservative minister from there. He was charged with doctrinal error and disturbing the peace and unity of the Presbyterian Church. The case, which was essentially about whether he should stand trial for heresy later, was heard by the General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church of New Zealand in Christchurch and attracted huge publicity. One wit, in a letter to the editor, asked whether if he was found guilty, he'd be stoned to death by church elders. As one recent reviewer of Jim Veitch's book commented,
"At its heart, the heresy trial of 1967 was about Auckland versus Dunedin. You really could have called it a tale of two cities. Dunedin was intellectually open, cerebral and egalitarian. Auckland was narrow-minded and conservative, run by old men with deep pockets."
In the background were Sir James Fletcher and Sir William Godfellow, wealthy Auckland businessmen who were early backers of the Layman's Association. Gehring conducted himself with quiet dignity and set forth what recent research had concluded about the Christian religion. During his trial, he claimed that the bones of Jesus lay somewhere in Palestine and that the resurrection had been wrongfully interpreted by churches as a resurrection of the body of Jesus. He also rejected the belief that God is a supernatural being who created the world. Even Gehring's opponents had to concede that his 90-minute address, reproduced in full in the following morning's newspapers, was brilliant. The result of the trial was an anticlimax, and the complaints against him were quietly dismissed. In May 1970, he was called once again to explain himself to the church. He had done a TV interview in Brisbane and went much further than he'd ever had in public before. He said Jesus was not the Son of God. Virgin birth did not happen. Heaven and hell did not exist in any real sense, and there was no life after death. A later part of the interview did not attract as much attention. Here is what Gehring also said.
"I think Christianity is a challenge to men to forget themselves and to live for others. It's not an easy challenge, and in fact, it never has been. And this, I think, is the heart of the Christian message still."
Later that year, Gehring accepted the position of Chair in Religious Studies at Victoria University. He continued to be regarded as a genuine, intelligent, and leading theologian, publishing books soberly examining the Christian faith. He also went on to win many civilian honours. When he was 95, he preached a memorable sermon at St Andrew's Church on the Terrace in Wellington, in which he said about Jesus,
"This man, far from being a divine figure, was primarily a teacher, a man who first came to be honoured for his wisdom. The rediscovery of the original Jesus has been very timely. for he and his teaching are much more relevant to the way we understand the world today than the traditional figure of a divine Christ who burst into our earthly world from a heavenly world in order to save our souls for another world.
Sir Lloyd Gearing remains a Presbyterian minister to this day. This is Bill Southworth reporting.
Dunedin has produced many important medical figures, and none more so than in the field of plastic surgery. Bill Southworth has been looking at the careers of two wartime plastic surgeons, who were not only important pioneers in the field, but who were also related.
Sir Harold Gillies and Sir Archibald McIndoe were cousins, born 18 years apart in Dunedin. Both received their knighthoods for developing groundbreaking techniques of plastic surgery in separate world wars. Harold Gillies was the elder of the two. He was born in 1882, the son of Robert Gillies, the Member of Parliament for Otago. After secondary education in New Zealand, he studied medicine at Cambridge University in England, specialising in ear, nose and throat surgery. He then joined St Bartholomew's Hospital in London and soon became a lecturer in plastic surgery at the hospital's medical school. When World War I broke out, he joined the Royal Army Medical Corps, and after service in France, he joined the facial injury ward at Aldershot. He soon saw the need for a much larger unit and persuaded the authorities to set up a unit at Sidcup. The Queen's Hospital opened in June 1917, and with its convalescent units providing over 1,000 beds. There, Gillies and his colleagues developed many innovative plastic surgery techniques. More than 11,000 operations were performed for over 5,000 men. For his work there, Gillies would become known as the father of modern plastic surgery. A New Zealand nurse was to write,
"Before the Great War, men with shattered faces died of wounds or broken hearts. Now they go to a special hospital where marvels of surgery are performed and they step out into the world again whole and competent. The commandant at Sidcup, I was flattered to discover, is a New Zealander."
Harold Gillies pioneered ways of dealing with bad burns. He noticed that a soldier patient had trouble sleeping. His eyelids had been burned off. To fix this, he came up with a revolutionary technique for making eyelids from skin grafts. It was simply one of the many innovative things he did there.
"Now that I can look about, I see how wonderful the work that has been done here to damaged heads. One man had absolutely no chin. It had all been shot away. But he's now been all fixed and is quite presentable. Another has a nose made out of one of his ribs, and he declares it is now better than the original."
An English nurse summed up Gillies' bedside manner.
"Don't worry, Sonny, you'll be all right, and have as good a face as most of us before we're finished with you," Captain Gillies would say. And the poor huddle of splints and bandages that had once been a handsome guardsman would believe him and try to shake off his mood of blank despair.
For this work, Gillies was knighted in 1930. In World War II, he continued his work on damaged soldiers. After the war, he was at the forefront of gender-affirming surgery. In 1946, he and a colleague carried out one of the first female-to-male operations. In 1951, he and colleagues carried out one of the first modern gender-affirming surgeries from male to female, using a flap technique which became standard for 40 years. At Cambridge University in 2015, Gonville and Caius College built 12 houses and named the road Gillies Close. Gillies Lane at Gun Park and the former Cambridge Military Hospital also commemorates him. In 1930, his cousin Archibald McIndoe arrived in London, and the two linked up as colleagues when Gillies, who was 18 years older and more advanced in his career, offered Archibald a surgery job at St Bartholomew's Hospital. Archibald McIndoe was born in 1900 in Forbury, Dunedin. His father was John McIndoe, the printer. He went to Otago Boys High School and then studied medicine at Otago University. In 1924, McIndoe was awarded the first New Zealand fellowship at the Mayo Clinic in the United States. After a stint with his cousin in London, McIndoe received a fellowship of the American College of Surgeons, where he worked until 1939. That year, he became a consultant plastic surgeon to the Royal North Stafford Infirmary and Croydon General Hospital. In 1938, he was appointed consultant in plastic surgery to the Royal Air Force. The Second World War created burn injuries amongst pilots which had never been seen before. A cabin on a Hurricane or Spitfire could turn into an inferno within seconds, and parts of the body, such as hands and faces, which were not covered by clothing, were burnt worst of all. Previously burnt skin had been treated by the painful technique of dripping tannic acid onto it to toughen it up. However, McIndoe noticed that pilots who had landed in the sea did not have such severe burns and healed more quickly. He developed a system of saltwater baths which helped to heal the skin. McIndoe realised his patients, many of whom were only 18 or 19, needed to develop mental toughness, and so he used psychological techniques to build up their self-esteem. He also made sure his patients were not treated as freaks. He deliberately hired older but nevertheless attractive nurses who could handle the sights they saw in the wards. He went to the nearby township of East Grinstead and persuaded its inhabitants not to stare at his patients when they went for a walk, but to treat them as normal. It worked so well that girls at local dances often asked his patients to dance with them. On one occasion, a pilot who had suffered moderate burn injuries was asked to go and see a former schoolmate in another ward who had asked to see him. They had signed up together as fighter pilots.
As I got to Ward 3, I saw what I can only describe as the most horrifying thing I had ever seen in my life. This chap had been really badly burnt. His hair had been burnt off. His eyebrows had been burnt off. His eyelids had been burnt off. You could just see his staring eyes. His nose had been burnt. You could just see two holes in his face. His lips had been burnt. And then, when I looked down, his legs and his feet were also burnt. He picked up a chair with his teeth and threw it alongside me and said, "Have a seat, old boy." And I cried. And I thought, what have I to complain about?
That friend recovered thanks to McIndoe and his colleagues and went on to fly fighters again. Much of what McIndoe did was trailblazing. The patients understood this and formed their own association, fondly called the Guinea Pig Club, which grew to have 700 members. For many years after the war, it provided social support for ex-pilots and their families. Specialist science laboratories at Otago Boys High School, built in 1967 and named in his honour. A school later named one of its houses after McIndoe. When he died at the age of 58, his ashes were given the unique honour for a civilian of being buried at the Royal Air Force Church of St Clement Danes in London. For much of this material, I'm grateful to the publications New Zealand History and Tiara, the Encyclopedia of New Zealand, and to the Royal Air Force Benevolent Fund. This is Bill Southworth reporting.
The local branch of Heritage New Zealand has been reaching out to children in order to get them interested in its work. One innovation is utilising the popularity of Lego to get them involved. This report from Alison Breeze.
At Heritage New Zealand Pohiriri Tonga, Otago Southland branch, we have recently focused on competitions promoting heritage with children. Our challenge was to build a structure from Heritage New Zealand Pohiriri Tonga's listed buildings within a local region in Lego or Minecraft. The latest competition was for Heritage South Heritage Month, which runs through March. Today, children absorb information through a variety of different forms of media. I wanted to create an engaging, hands-on, creative experience that involved children and their families undertaking local exploration in their areas. Heritage can support young people's development. For example, historic places can function as spaces where children engage in creative and imaginative play, which is important for developing children's emotional and cognitive skills. A study exploring how children relate to historic sites found that imagination is a key way through which children make sense of the past. Old buildings can give us a glimpse into the past way of life. There are often stories and artifacts associated with these buildings. The architecture of historic structures is also representative of a particular time and place. It might be parts of an old jetty or an old hospital. Historic places hold the stories of our past, are an important part of building community and create connections between who we were and who we aspire to be. By using Lego and Minecraft as popular platforms that children already engage in, we ran the competition to research and pick a listed building or structure off the HNZPT list and replicate it within the platforms. Lego building is a very popular hobby and is a fun way to recreate and study heritage structures or sites. Minecraft was released in 2011 and has become the best-selling video game in history with over 350 million copies sold. Minecraft is a game made up of blocks, creatures, and community, much like Lego. And in creative mode, you can have unlimited resources for building, and users can use their creativity to build historic worlds. Blocks can be broken, crafted, placed to reshape the landscape, or used to build fantastical creations. While both promoting HNZPT listings and fantastic heritage sites, it was wonderful to see so many children put effort into building replicas, some with their own interpretations as well. Children were encouraged to add descriptions to their creations, and these did not disappoint. My favourite comment being, "I don't mind if I don't win. I had a lot of fun making this, and that made it worth my time." One parent commented that their child developed patience, problem-solving skills, and gained confidence in the building process. With the Southland competition, it was great seeing kids get out and about soaking up their local history. One entry noted about the D Street Hospital buildings. They may not be the grandest buildings in Southland, but you can go right up to them and take photos. Another visited Acker's Cottage on Rakiura, Stewart Island. "I went to visit Acker's to try and make my creation as accurate as possible. You can see Harold's Bay in the foreground, surrounded by native bush. There is a broken window at the front, and it's dusty and old inside, with lots of remains, including old tools and bottles. This builder had added authenticity with added cobwebs that obviously stood out to him on his visit. Historic places have been reimagined in a digital world. A lot of children loved the ability to reimagine the buildings and design them with what they'd love to see. One child added bright and colourful bricks to make the building look more fun and creative while still maintaining its shape, a great improvement on the plain building. One entrant reimagined the Invercargill Water Tower interior. Because we did not have a chance to go inside the real building and could not find any photos of the interior, he used this opportunity to use his imagination to design the inside. From the ground up, this includes a library, a chest room, an aquarium, a redstone factory, a second aquarium, and finally a watcher's room at the top of the tower. Sounds amazing. Many of the entrants added fun animals such as dogs, pigs, cows, and horses to their landscapes. The competition shows how old buildings can be reimagined in a playful way, and children interpreted spaces they couldn't see in creative ways. Some of the children passed these structures regularly. One parent noted, "It was special to him because our family passes it almost every day when travelling between home and school." It shows the enthusiasm kids have for heritage and how architecture and history can be explored through creative technology and help them to understand and learn about their collective past. Southland Heritage Month is on for all of March, so go and check out all the events that are held down in Southland at heritagesouth.nz. You can find all our listings on our Heritage New Zealand list online at heritage.org.nz, and you too can go exploring in your local area. The story brought to you by Alison Breeze, reporting for Heritage Matters.
This show will be replayed on Thursday the 19th of March at 1 p.m. and on Sunday the 8th and 22nd of March at 7 p.m.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.